Na 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 sword.
All right, this is Pure Decking, show number 282 for Thursday. What is today? October something. 26th, 2017. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like information security, pointing out just how rigged the game is, and reminding you that you are now in a 12 miles required per hour zone enforced by government drone. I'm Morps. Tonight, I'm drinking beer barrel bourbon, and we have Madman. Madman, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking a Newcastle Brown Ale.
Ah, excellent. We are also testing out the brand new broadcast box, so if there's no recording posted to this show, it didn't work. So far, so good. Seems to be working. I had my share of issues getting it all sorted out there, but it appears to finally be working, and that's a good, can only be a good thing, because that means I get to retire the long struggling broadcast box that really, really needs a format and reinstall. And and now we're finally running it on a full-on Linux build as opposed to a Windows build, which can only help, because I've had my share of issues with that Windows install. So, but nobody else will care about any of this, because it's all just convenient for me, although I do have to relearn my timings, because I kind of got used to the remote control software having a touch of delay on the sound effects during the intro there, so I've got to relearn that, or it's just going to be wrong. Muscle memory. So, anyways, let's move on to our first story here. This is from The New Scientist. Gaming addiction probably isn't a real condition, study suggests.
Oh, I could have told you that. Along with sex addiction, if anyone was wondering, that one's fake too.
There may be no such thing as internet gaming addiction. People play excessively not because they are hooked on gaming itself, but because they feel unhappy about other areas of their life, according to a study that followed thousands of online gamers over 6 months. I love it. The study concluded people who play WoW are not happy with their real life. It's like, no, it's not escapism. Why would you think that? Internet gaming disorder is referenced in the Diagnostic Standard Manual of Mental Disorders as a condition of further study, meaning the American Psychiatric Association thinks it warrants further research as a potential psychiatric condition. The manual suggests that people suspected of suffering from gaming disorder must fulfill five or more criteria from a list of nine that include lying about time spent gaming, jeopardizing jobs, careers, or education because of participating in gaming.
Are those each separate?
No, that's one option.
Damn it.
Using gaming... wait a minute. Five or more from a list of nine that include... Okay, so it's not the complete list. And using gaming to relieve anxiety. Well, I think a lot of people do that. That doesn't mean they're addicted. They must also feel distress over their gaming habits for a yet-to-be-defined period of time. To investigate the potential prevalence of the disorder based on this criteria, Netta Weinstein at Cardiff University in the UK and her colleagues used a nationally representative sample informed by US Census data to identify 2,316 people over the age of 18 who regularly play games online. The participants filled in a questionnaire covering aspects of their health, physical activity, and lifestyle. At the start of the study, only nine participants met five or more criteria and experienced distress as a result of their gaming. However, none still met this criteria 6 months later, and they were not diagnosed with addiction. Three people matched four or more criteria at the beginning and end of the study. However, none felt ongoing distress over their gaming habits. We did not see a large number of people with clinical problems, said Weinstein. The study's results suggest that it's not clear how many resources should go into gaming addiction compared to other addictions like drugs. Further analysis by the team showed that people who displayed some sort of pronounced symptom of gaming addiction had lower needs fulfillment, meaning they were unhappy with other areas of life, such as a relationship or their careers. This suggests that gaming might be a displacement activity for people in an unhappy situation rather than an addiction, says Weinstein. 6 months later, the symptoms of gaming disorder were reduced in those who had become more content since the first questionnaire. This initial evidence that having more needs fulfilled in life can make people feel better about their gaming, said Weinstein. Treatment for game addiction includes scrutinizing life outside gaming, says Kimberly Young, a clinical psychologist who specializes in internet addiction. Addicted players need to examine their emotional motives that prompt them to play a game excessively and look for alternative ways to satisfy those needs, she says. Gaming addiction is a real problem that deserves recognition, says Dario Cuss, a cyber psychology. How do you get that job title? Cyber psychology researcher at Nottingham Trent University, UK. Is that the psychology of computers? How do you get that job title? Using
write a thesis and have nothing else to study.
I can bullshit my way through a thesis. Let's see. Using questionnaires to study addiction can be misleading, as people tend to underreport bad behavior, says Cuss. If someone uses gambling to meet basic psychological needs, this could become a problem if they are not able to satisfy those needs in real life, she says. But to confirm this, we need clinical samples of people who are actually being treated in for addiction in centers. So they're arguing over sample and reporting style. Cyber psychology sounds... It does, doesn't it? I mean, it really does sound kinky, doesn't it?
They need to pay me to do this survey.
To what?
I think I could have a problem. They could cure me with checks for my disability.
I like that. Don't ask. To get that title, you draw it on a sticky name tag with crayon and slap it on your forehead. I like it. You just take the crayon and scratch out whatever's on your current business card and put that. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think you're right. Anybody could have told you that no, it's not the gaming that's the addiction. It's something else going on, and that it may or may not even really be an addiction. So I just think it's hilarious that somebody took the time and did a bunch of questionnaires to study gaming addiction. And if the given the number of people who would actively defend playing video games, if you told them that's what they were studying, would they lie about it? I'd kind of like to see the questionnaires.
Possibly.
I mean, if you have somebody who's addicted to, I don't know, what's a game to be addicted to? Hello Kitty Island Adventure. They might be so embarrassed that they are addicted to Hello Kitty Island Adventure that they're going to lie to even questionnaires to strangers on the internet, you know, who they have no reason to trust. Minecraft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people that spend a lot of time in Minecraft.
I don't think that's called internet gaming addiction. I think that's just called autism. Really? Not touching that one?
Not touching that one. But I'd also go with finding the games where people have died playing them. That's something to study.
Well, that was in Korea, wasn't it? They had that guy who died playing StarCraft.
They had people die playing StarCraft, playing World of Warcraft, and playing Evercrack.
Well, okay, but to be fair, if it was a slave dungeon doing gold mining, it's not surprising that somebody died given the working conditions.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think if any of these people were gold farmers.
I mean,
I'm
going
to have to be
it.
Sad now. They weren't really video game addicted. They had a gun put to their head and said, click! You must click everything for the gold!
Oh, I kind of hope when they're doing the gold farming, they do the bad English.
No click, no more rice for you. No rice.
Oh, jeez. So
yeah, that wasn't gaming addiction. You're right, that's forced labor.
I mean, you know, we had that problem in the 1800s. People died during that all the time. It's like when you see those rigs that the photo comes out every once in a while, where it's like some Chinese person in a warehouse somewhere, sitting in front of this jigged up thing made out of like plywood and wire of 100 cell phones, all just, you know, rigged up in one giant display, and they're going through sitting there like leaving good reviews on apps and shit, because that's what their company gets paid to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really sucks trying to go through apps, you know, when you know about these kind of things where there are these, you know, review houses that'll go out there and, like, you know, you pay them $100 and they'll put 1,000 likes on a Facebook post, or, you know, 100 views on a YouTube video or some bullshit. And it's not bots, which is what you would assume. It's people sitting in warehouses somewhere in China with a whole crap ton of smartphones or, you know, laptops or whatever, just sitting there, you know, clicking on stuff because they're paid to click on it. So,
how cheap is your life that you're cheaper than a Perl script?
Well, I think they're less likely to be detected as a bot if they're, you know, rather than the Perl script. Because at least then there's actually human input, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Of course, I'm sure they've got scripts and shit helping them. I mean, I don't know how else you could keep up with that kind of stuff, but just the sheer prevalence of it means that, yeah, you basically can't trust, especially like if it's a new app or a new book or something new on Amazon, and it's got a whole bunch of perfect ratings, and everyone talks about how wonderful it is without getting really specific about the whatever the thing is. Yeah, especially if the English is bad, you know that it's probably all paid for, farmed reviews. So you got to wait until you start seeing a bad review or two come in and then read those and be like, all right, is there actually a problem here, or is this somebody who just couldn't figure it out? That's actually usually my indicator I look for when I'm looking at, like, if I'm going to buy something on Amazon. I'm not looking for the good reviews. I want to see the 1- and 2-star reviews and see if it's just somebody who didn't know how to work what they bought. If I see a bunch of that and that's all the bad reviews are, I usually think, okay, now that's a good product, because it's like you're going to get people complaining when they can't figure it out. But I don't know. I don't know. Madman, would you say you suffer from internet gaming addiction?
Depends. Is this being recorded to be used at my hearing later on? Because if so, yes. If not, it's a fictitious disease.
Well, considering we're not using your real name.
Oh, then, oh God, no, this is crap. This is, honey, I forgot our anniversary 5 years in a row. Please don't blame me. I have a horrible addiction. I had to take down Naxxramas one more time. It's escapism. It's not, I'm not even sure it's a problem. Unless you're actually letting it eat your life. Because you should still have friends. You should still go out and socialize with actual people. And I've been in guilds that were close. I met many people in real life.
Wait a minute. Actual people?
Actual people.
I might be doing things wrong.
And, yeah. Time spent online still isn't real time with people.
Making a note. Doing it wrong. Anyways, so yeah, bad joke. I was kind of hoping we'd have Fox or Sard on, because it'd be kind of fun to get some more opinions on this. But I mean, you know, there were all those stories back, like, when World of Warcraft was the big thing, of how many people were, like, losing their life to it, losing their jobs, and just doing nothing but playing that game.
Oh yeah, it ate a shit ton of my life. But that's also because I didn't have much of a life that I didn't want to devote to the game. I didn't know what I wanted to do in school, so I let it lax. And my friends were moving off at the time. So for a while, I spent 80 hours, or not 80 hours, about 40 hours a week in World of Warcraft. 40 hours a week working.
Yeah. And knowing how you deal with the chat in those games, it must have been a rather lonely experience. No, anyways. For those of you who think I'm making fun of Madman for being lonely and WoW, I'm not. I'm making fun of the fact that you can text message Madman all day long in any game he plays, and he will never see it.
Oh, yeah. I very rarely look at the text unless I'm in a group, and then I have that color different, and I look at whatever the group I'm looking in is saying.
So, But yeah, I don't think that's gaming addiction. I think they're right in the initial article that that's something else going on. It's not. I mean, addiction in my mind implies some kind of a chemical behavior. You know, it's like, you know, you can be addicted to a drug. You can be addicted to alcohol. I think
you can be addicted to certain actions as well, because when you do something, it does change the chemical response in your brain. Like, adrenaline junkies do exist. There are people that can be addicted to pain, but this is so rare, I'm not even sure it merits treating. And it's not that I want to see people suffer. It's, I don't know that the money is worth spending on it, because you could choose to treat something else and save millions of people, or you could choose to treat adrenaline junkies and save five.
Yeah, I mean, especially because adrenaline junkies, if they're doing it right, are probably not going to kill themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess there's gambling addiction, isn't there? I mean, people say that's a real thing.
People say it's a real thing, yeah.
I guess that could be. I mean, maybe a lot of these behavioral things are like all the same kind of addiction. It's sort of like an adrenaline junkie where it's that dopamine hit. So maybe, you know, maybe somebody with a gaming addiction, it's the same addiction as a gambling addict or, I don't know, a sex addict. And it's because they're getting that reward center in their brain to tick off for doing something.
I'm still going to go sex addiction isn't a thing. You just want to get your rocks off. Every guy is born with sex addiction. I'm told it goes away about 4 days after you die.
4 days? You're being optimistic?
Yeah, I don't think your body can get an erection after that. But near death, and for a few days after death, you can still get a boner. So yeah, a chick can ride a dead guy.
Well, she I don't know can why do that anyways. You're just, you know, suffering from a lack of creativity, sir. I mean, popsicle sticks and duct tape are a thing.
Oh, splinters, that's horrible. Also a thing.
So, but yeah, I don't know, man. Of course, the psychological stuff gets weird quick because it's all usually so individual anyways. So, anyways. Yeah, Psychros brings up porn addiction. I'm betting people say that's a thing, too. So, I don't know. Everything's an addiction, because if it's an addiction, you don't have to take responsibility for your actions because you're an addict. That's how that works, right?
That's the way people want it to work. The addicts that recover take responsibility.
Yeah, I'm betting that's a subset. Rather small subset, truthfully.
Yes.
So, let's move on to other stories here. This next one up with some Reuters. Microsoft is going to drop. Microsoft Corp said it will drop a lawsuit against the U.S. government after the Department of Justice changed data request rules on alerting internet users about how agencies accessing their information. The new policy limits the use of secrecy orders and calls for such orders to be issued for defined periods, Microsoft Chief Legal Officer Brad Smith said in a blog post on Monday. As a result of the issuance of this policy, we are taking steps to dismiss our lawsuit, Smith said. The company expects the changes to end the practice of indefinite secrecy orders. Microsoft filed the lawsuit in April 16, arguing that the U.S. government was violating the Constitution by preventing the company from informing its customers about government requests for their emails and other documents. The suit argued that the government's actions were in violation of the Fourth Amendment, which established the right for the people and businesses to know if the government searches or seizes their property, and the company's First Amendment right to free speech. These changes will ensure that secrecy orders requests are carefully and specifically tailored to the facts of the case, Smith said. This is an important step for both privacy and free expression. It is an unequivocal win for our customers, and we're pleased the DOJ has taken these steps to protect constitutional rights of all Americans, the statement said. While Microsoft has agreed to drop the suit, Smith said the company is renewing its call to Congress for the amendment of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which was adopted in 1986. The DOJ did not respond for a request to comment outside of regular business hours. Last week, U.S. Supreme Court agreed to hear the Trump administration's appeal of a lower court's ruling preventing federal prosecutors from retaining emails stored in Microsoft's computer servers in Dublin, Ireland, in a drug trafficking investigation. Why are they blaming that on Trump? That's been going on for years.
It's his administration continuing. They didn't drop the suit.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Government lawyers argued the lower court ruling threatened national security and public safety. So, I was going to say, though, I mean, that's not Trump's lawsuit, but I guess yeah, he could just dismiss his team could just drop it if they wanted to. Although, I suppose in situations like that, I mean, usually those lawsuits are handled by people lower down the totem pole. Don't you just kind of inherit those and whatever they're working on whenever you change administrations?
You inherit it, but it still becomes that administration's suit. Like, and as an example, the gay marriage ruling, that suit started before Obama, but because it was settled under Obama, it was considered a ruling with him.
Oh, okay. Oh, so that I'm misreading that. They're not blaming anybody. That's just tradition of how you talk about this stuff.
Yeah, that's the tradition. Whatever the new administration is, if they don't drop it, it becomes their suit.
Okay. Because I've gotten so used to pretty much anything anywhere going on, the news is just going to blame Trump, whether he's got anything to do with it or not. It's like, no, we've talked about this Dublin, Ireland suit many times. It's like, I know that wasn't Trump because it's too old.
Yeah. So, but technically, since he's now the head of the executive and can order the suit dropped, he hasn't, it becomes his, even though he might not even know it exists.
That's what I was going to say. You think he even knows about it?
Probably not.
Yeah.
A lot of this is on autopilot.
So, all right. Well, that's what I get for getting used to how the news works today and just misreading it. Not that I have any great love for Trump. I think he's better than what we could have gotten, but it's like, at least be fair. I mean, come on, you know? So, anyways, so Microsoft is finally dropping the Dublin, Ireland email suit because the DOJ says they're changing their rules. That doesn't solve my initial problem, which was that server's in Ireland. The emails on those servers are in Ireland.
I think they just referenced that suit. I believe this is two different suits they're talking about.
Oh. Did I misread it? It's possible. I've been drinking. So. All right. Well, if all they're doing is referencing it, that's fine then. Because my problem was always the jurisdictional one of... Yeah, how is our government forcing companies to hand over stuff that's in another country? So,
yeah, the Supreme Court is still hearing the Dublin, Ireland one. This is Microsoft was suing the federal government, saying that you can't tell us not to tell our customers when you're putting them under surveillance and want their crap. Now they're saying, okay, we won't tell our customers so long as there's a set time frame for our silence. So if the DOJ shows up with a warrant saying, hi, we want everything you have on Madman, you can't talk about it for 30 years. Because there's a set time frame on it, they're not going to argue.
Do you think 30 years is actually going to be a realistic number?
I don't know if it's going to be a realistic number, but they don't have the number. And a lot of requests, it's not... And when it comes to the government, a lot of things they decide to keep secret... It's the life of that person plus so many years.
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, I could see it being a request for years because lawsuits can take that long. But I'm just, I mean, if it's going to be
30 is an exaggeration. It might be 5, but they're still saying it has to have a specified number of years. Well, if I'm being searched now, I think I should be informed about the warrant you have on me now rather than after the lawsuit's over.
Well, there's that. But I guess the other thing about this that I think is kind of odd, and this is kind of, might be a weird place to take it. So if you're saying that this company has a responsibility to never mention this security letter and this security request, Most companies have data retention policies where they only keep documents and data for a set number of years, and it depends on the industry. Things like system logs, they might only keep for 6 months versus, you know, legal documents they'll usually keep for like 7 years, or, life of the agreement plus 7 years, stuff like that. So, you know, if you start saying, no, you have to do this indefinitely, and they have a data retention policy of only keeping data for, you know, I don't know, 7 years or something, and now you're forcing them to keep it forever. I mean, eventually you're going to fill up hard drives of this shit. I don't know.
I don't know if they'll keep it forever. But the argument Microsoft was making is they want to tell their customers. The Department of Justice was saying, don't tell your customers. So if Microsoft just doesn't store it, they can't tell their customers. The DOJ would be happy with that.
Yeah, because then that gives them more freedom and more, because they have more leeway just to do whatever at that point. They're not as, you know, they don't risk a challenge to anything they're doing if they're able to do it all without the person they're investigating even knowing about it.
But, you're right, Cycros. The JFK is still getting stuff declassified after 50 years.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he wasn't going to. It kept getting extended, wasn't it?
Now some of it was.
Yeah, and Trump said he's not going to, so. He's just going to let it release, which that's cool. You all know that's not going to be any of the actual incriminating shit that was in some of those documents. The documents with the incriminating shit got burned, like, you know, the minute they were written.
Possibly along with the person that wrote them.
Yeah. Because, you know, I mean, I don't know how much of a conspiracy there really is with the JFK stuff, but it is a little weird, some of the shit that went down around that. So. Why doesn't MS have a foreign employee break rank and tell customers get fired and then get rehired? Oh, no. You haven't been paying attention. They have to make sure they have a foreign employee who's not in a country with extradition laws, because they had people in the UK get extradited to the US for running a streaming site. So that's rough. And if it ever came out that the company sanctioned that kind of behavior, yeah.
Ooh, MS North Korea.
It's a PO box and one guy who works from home. So, next one up is also a crazy copyright thing. So let's paste that.
And is it a destruction? Because that's always awesome.
No, unfortunately not. Let's see, it's from Torrent Freak. A Sky customer who illegally streamed Sky Sports content via a piracy blog has been ordered to pay 16,000 euros in legal costs to the broadcaster. UK-based Yusuf Mohammed has also been ordered to provide the personal details of his co-conspirators while revealing how much he made for his activities. Well, let's see, that'd be Google AdWords. So I made $15. As yet, unspecified damages payable to Sky are also not part of the order. Without a doubt, streaming is the hot topic in piracy right now, with thousands of illicit channels, TV shows, and movies just a few clicks away. As widely reported, the illegal Kodi software augmented with illegal third-party add-ons, or I'm not illegal, illicit. The word is illicit, because I don't know how some of these add-ons are technically illegal. Is the preferred way to watch for millions of users. However, if people don't mind sitting at a desktop machine, there's also the thriving underbelly of indexing sites and similar platforms offering unauthorized access to infringing content. Oh, that's just a lack of creativity on the author's part. It is stupid easy to use a Chromecast or just a really long HDMI cable and still watch this stuff on a big screen. According to information released by the Federation Against Copyright Theft, the Federation Against Copyright Theft. Please tell me they have uniforms and little Starfleet badges. An individual in the UK has just felt the wrath of the High Court for providing content to one such platform. On Monday, 23rd of October, 2017, a judgment was obtained in the High Court against a Sky customer who'd been streaming Sky Sports illegally. I can't read tonight. against a Sky customer who had been streaming Sky Sports content illegally online, Fact reports. Mr. Youssef Mohammed of Bristol has been ordered to pay legal costs of over 16,000 euros and to disclose details about the money he made and the people he colluded with. With Fact releasing no more information, Tor Freak contacted the anti-piracy group for more details on the case. Mohammed shared the Sky Sports stream via a piracy blog. Fact director of communications Alice Skeets told Tor piracy blog. I want to bet it was like his personal Tumblr or some bullshit. Although Fact didn't directly answer our questions on the topic, their statement that Mohammed was a Sky customer seems to suggest that he might have restreamed content he previously paid for. When we can clarify the point, that we will. Fact did not name the piracy blog either, nor did it respond to questions about how many people may have viewed Mohammed's illegal streams. However, Fact did confirm that he streamed Sky Sports channel so potentially a wide range of sports was made available. Another interesting factor is the claim that Mohammed made money from his streamers. Again, the Fact didn't reveal how that revenue was generated. Understandable since the case is ongoing, but it seems likely that advertising played a part, as it often does on piracy platforms. Well, duh. That's how any website makes money most of the time. Whether Mohammed will comply with the High Court's orders to reveal who he colluded with is something for the future, but even if he does, Sky isn't finished with him. According to Fact, Mohammed's already sizable costs bill will be augmented with a claim for damages from the satellite broadcaster. While providing and profiting from illegal streams could easily be considered criminal in the UK, Fact confirmed the case against Mohammed was brought by Sky and supported by Fact in a civil proceeding alone. Well, yeah, because if he goes to jail, you'll never get any settlement out of him. That was also the case last week when an individual who shared the Joshua versus Klitschko fight on Facebook apologized to Sky and agreed to pay Sky's legal costs. Man, the UK's anti-piracy laws must be a lot stricter. Because, I mean, they've got their people actually apologizing. We're sorry. Please don't kill us.
I mean, in the UK, you have to buy a television license more.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. If you don't pay your television license, you can't watch TV at all. It's a tax in that country. So when you pirate in the UK, you're not just swiping money from whatever company you're pirating from. You are swiping money from the crown.
So then they go on to continue talking about Kodi boxes, even though they never actually mention, you know, I don't think Kodi boxes are actually related to the case. I think Torrent Freak is just bringing them up because it's something to pad the article with. But yeah, because it sounds like he was posting it. They say a piracy blog, and if you're saying piracy blog, that makes me think like a Tumblr or a WordPress site.
I was thinking he was just streaming it on some whatever website.
Yeah,
IamAwesome.com. Watch my sporting events.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, maybe with a banner ad running on the side or something. I mean, I'm betting this guy did not make a lot of money off this. The whole point of people pirating stuff is they don't want to pay for it. Oh, Cycross is saying there's plugins for Kodi that index some of these blogs. So, yeah, it could have been like a Tumblr or a live stream or something like that where he knew it would get picked up by Kodi and used. But again, they never referenced Kodi in the actual facts of what they're talking about. I think that was more the author just padding it because, you know, they've had several stories on Pirate on a Tort Freak about Kodi boxes and people having to pay settlements for those. So, yeah, I'm betting he didn't make a hell of a lot of money. That'd be an interesting Patreon, though, wouldn't it? I'll hook a live stream TV card up to my cable box and stream the sports events, you know, for every dollar a month or whatever.
Oh, yeah, that'd be amazing. Depending on the events, like MMA, I'd pay a buck for that.
Well, you know, that kind of points out a lot of the problems and some of the reason this stuff exists. Is that they've got this stuff so locked down that, oh, you have to have an account with a cable provider, and you have to have this, and you have to have that, and, oh, you're not in the UK, so you can't watch these fights. Whereas, you know, you just said it. I'd pay a couple of bucks to watch that. It's like, you know, if you just go on and a la carte buy the event you want and watch a live stream of it, I bet a lot of people would do that to avoid the headache of finding a Kodi plugin that works this week. That's the other thing, is I know those things have problems because I may or may not have played with them in the past, and sometimes they just quit working.
If cable had an a la carte package, I would still have television. The reason I finally shut it off isn't because I found a better way of watching TV. I was already watching most of my TV online. The reason I shut off my cable was the three channels that I was watching, I couldn't get on the cheap cable package anymore.
At this point, I don't have cable TV just out of pure spite. So,
I liked news, and when they took away BBC World News, CNN, and Fox, I'm like, okay, I'm now not watching anything on my television. I don't need cable.
No, I was getting a phone call a week for like 2 months from Spectrum trying to say, oh, no, you need to add a... And fuck it, I don't care to say I'm using Spectrum because they're terrible. Soon, if I had another option for an ISP in this area, believe me, I'd be on it. I was getting a phone call about once a week from them for several months. Like, why haven't you added TV? You can add TV for $30 a month. It's like, because I won't use it. My favorite was I tried to be nice to one guy to try to get him to take me off their fucking call list. So it's like, dude, quit reading your script. Well, I'm supposed to read that. No, stop. I'm not going to buy TV. Just, can you please ask them to stop calling me every week? And then he goes, right, but, well, what's your hesitation with signing up for this TV and movie package? So in other words, right back on script, right? My hesitation is I'm not going to use it, asshole. And, I hung up on him. I got a call next week. And how I got him to quit calling me?
Cussed them out?
I asked if... I said, are you niggers going to keep calling me once a week? And the guy got real mad at me on the phone and hung up. I'm not proud of that. But guess what? I think if you get put on the abuse list, they leave you alone.
So, charges you less to have TV, you have 8 channels. They're probably the broadcast channels that you could still pick up with an antenna. Am I correct?
That's the funny part, is it's if it was cheaper, I'd do it. It's not. They want me to pay another 10-15 bucks a month for it. But, I still get something in the mail about it every other day, trying to get me to sign up for cable or satellite. So... I think I'm considered a cord cutter, and I think the cable companies are starting to get desperate about it because their markets are not growing.
Yep, they just need to go a la carte, because I could find some channels I would buy. I just don't want their package because it's mostly shit.
Well, yeah, I mean, if instead of saying here's your package, this is your this is what you get. If it's like your package, you pick the 5 channels you want, and that's $10 a month, or if you want 20 channels, it's $20, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think they'd have a lot more people still paying to watch TV. Of course, then they have other people who just, it's like the newspaper. They just, or a landline. It's more habit at this point than it is any actual major use of it. Like my parents. My parents will have cable TV until they're both dead. And probably even after that, because it'll probably be difficult to get the cable companies to admit that they're dead and stop billing them. But that's a different argument. They'll probably have it until the day they're dead. They'll probably have that landline. They still have the same landline they had when I was a kid. They'll probably have that till the end of days. Just.
And you're right, Cycros. Cycros put a link or a comment in chat. He thinks... the reason they're giving him a break on his bill is for the ad revenue.
Probably true.
And that is true. They base their ad rates on what they can sell for each channel based on their so-called viewership. If not enough people are buying cable channels, price for the ads they can charge on cable go down. So that's why some cable companies will give you a discount. Mine used to. The reason I had cable television for a while is the bundle was cheaper for my internet than just internet alone. that went away when my cable company changed.
Yeah, see, that's the problem I have, is it's like they bug the shit out of you trying to get get your dad TV, but it's not cheaper, it's more expensive. It's like, well, why would I do that? I'm not going to watch it. So, I mean, seriously, at a very basic level, I'm not going to watch it. Why would I pay for it?
I wonder how much this guy, how much this dude's going to end up getting fined.
Well, considering they haven't done damages yet, they just, you know, done legal costs. He's already lost, so I'm betting they're going to go. That's why they're asking for how much he made and who his co-conspirators are. So they want to, like, figure out the maximum amount that was made so they can settle damages. And when they figured out he made, like, $50 over, like, a couple of months and just ad revenue, they're probably just going to drop it. Just, like, pay the legal fees and be done with it. So.
I believe we've moved to next up.
Have we moved to next up? Let's see. Next up is from TechCrunch. Congress votes to disallow customers from suing Equifax and other companies with arbitration agreements.
Fuck you.
That is the correct response. The Senate voted late Tuesday night to strike a federal rule that would allow millions of consumers. I'm sorry. Let me reread this. The Senate voted late Tuesday night to strike a federal rule that would have allowed consumers affected by the Equifax hack to sue the company. Without it, the millions of affected by the historic security breach may be disallowed from related joining class action lawsuits. The specific rule, and only this rule, would be nullified if the joint resolution is signed by the president. The vote was 50-50 with the tie-breaking yay cast by Vice President Pence. The rule in question was entered in the Federal Registry by the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection in July. It prevents financial companies that bind their users by arbitration agreements from prohibiting those same users from suing as a class. The quote here, the final rule prohibits cover providers of certain consumer financial products. I hate government language. Da-da-da-da-da. Yeah, so it's just restating that rule. And the weird thing was with Equifax, a lot of people who wouldn't have directly been customers of theirs, but because they signed up for credit protection, now they can't. Now they can't sue them. You know, if you agreed to credit protection from Equifax, you now can no longer sue them because you agreed to only do arbitration. So, for anybody who doesn't know, arbitration is interesting. It's a system where instead of going to court, you go and get viewed by you have your argument listened to by a magistrate, or it's not a magistrate, is it? What is it, Madman? Help me out.
It varies. Sometimes you're going before a judge, but it's not in court and you don't have all the court costs. Sometimes you're going before a lawyer who just adjudicates.
Well,
you
okay,
can actually have a random person on the street be your arbiter.
Well, the weird thing about it is, usually because you're agreeing to arbitration by agreement, it's the company that's paying the lawyer or the judge or whoever's being the arbiter in this case. So they have a strong incentive to side in the company's favor. And because it's not court, you don't have all the legal protections. You don't have, you know, the company can basically set the parameters of what arguments you're allowed to use in arbitration. So it's basically stacked. You could win in arbitration, but it would have to be really blatant. And I mean, like, you know, the companies are, you know, arbiter, like, over there, like, mooning the judge kind of thing.
Can I give you an idea? Family Court, that TV show, that was arbitration. Same thing as Judge Judy. They both do arbitration.
Yeah. So, but that one's done for a TV show. It's a little different.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're less stacked on individual people, but it's the most, it's the arbitration everyone could see.
Yeah. Yeah, these are done in private, and it's for a reason.
Yeah.
So, That's exactly what the terms of Equifax services included when users went to the company's site to see if they were affected by the hack. Although the site in question appears to have been essentially useless, it shunted users into an Equifax-provided service with terms that bound disputes to be resolved via arbitration. Equifax later modified some of its terms to remove the arbitration clauses because they got caught, and also indicated that the Trusted ID Service FAQ, the clauses apply to the free credit file monitoring and identity theft protection products, not the cybersecurity incident. Nevertheless, it's very unclear just what users may or may not have signed up for and to what degree Equifax is protected by these terms. Arbitration agreements have been effective in preventing class action lawsuits. The BCFP rule was made to prevent major incidents like this one from having their legal repercussions partially nullified. HJRez 111 was introduced on July 20th, the day after the rule above was instituted. Its entire purpose is to disapprove of that specific rule. It passed the House on July 25th, 231-190, split right down the party lines except for one defecting Republican who voted nay with the Democrats. In the Senate, the split was 50-50 with two Republicans, Louisiana's John Neely Kennedy and South Carolina's Lindsey Graham, joining the Democrats with the nays. The VP broke the tie, and the joint resolution passed shortly before 10 p.m. Eastern time. The Monopoly Man was not present. For those of you who don't get that reference, there was a guy dressed up as the Monopoly Man during the Equifax hearings. It was hilarious. It's like he's sitting there looking all interested, raising the monocle. I mean, it's just, you know, somebody trolling, but, you know, doing it expertly. It is not entirely clear what effect, if any, this would have on the Equifax situation specifically, since the company has voluntarily limited the scope of its arbitration terms, although clearly it's a serious blow to consumer protection at large. Not a fan of companies being able to get you to agree to circumvent the legal system, especially in the case of Equifax, where they don't make it clear that that's what you're doing.
In the rules for arbitration, it isn't actually Equifax or the company that sets the rules. They pick the arbiter. The rules for arbitration are already set usually before any cases are even brought.
Well, if you're picking the arbiter, don't you think the rules that arbiter are going to be using are in the contract when you sign it?
Yep, and they're also listed by the arbiter prior to signing.
Yeah, they're picking the rules that best suit what they want. You know this. You're right. They're not changing the rules in the middle of the game. I'm not accusing them of that. But they are certainly picking the most favorable situation they can. You're not going to be able to tell me otherwise.
Oh, no. They're also picking the most favorable jurisdiction they can.
Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, you want to do arbitration? Yeah, it's in Hawaii. Oh, you're going to have to travel there on your own. They usually don't pick it based on, you know, what's remote and expensive to travel to. They do it based on, you know, what laws are most favorable to them, but still.
Yeah.
So, did I throw the next link in?
But one thing about this that I'm kind of torn on, class action is a very crappy way of doing lawsuits. Because in kind of the defense of a company, and this doesn't defend Equifax because Equifax is blatantly guilty, but in many class actions, you're not getting more evidence. What you're doing is stacking on so-called victims and trying to get the jury to cry and say the big company's a bad man. So there is a problem with just class actions in general in this
country. Well, that might be what they passed that rule for. July 20th, that would be before Equifax announced their findings, so it's not like Congress is blatantly trying to cover for Equifax here. So,
but this one, as an example, is a horrible one to go by because Equifax, were they directly wrong, or was it one of their vendors that got them popped? I forget.
Oh, they were directly wrong.
Oh, then, yeah, it's a terrible.
Not only were they directly wrong, they were directly wrong multiple times and did one of the worst ways to handle a breach. In that they tried to dismiss it, they buried it, they tried to release the news about it during a hurricane to mask the problem. Yeah, they their board of governors was like, what is the absolute worst way we can fuck this up? Great, let's do that. So, my real problem with class action is you join a lawsuit because you were wronged by a company and potentially scammed out of a lot of money, and you'll get a check for $20. Because the lawyers take half of it or all of it.
They take a huge chunk of it, and then what's left? Think of lawyers generally get a third as kind of a generic rule. So if you settle for $30 million, 10 of it's going to the lawyers, and $20 million's going among everyone that's in the class action.
Which and is lawyers, usually thousands.
They want to stack more people in the class action because they're going with sympathy by numbers. So by the time all the results roll out, you're getting $25 when individually you probably should have got a few thousand or maybe, you know, tens of thousands, whatever.
Or at least like the cost of the product that was defective, because that's usually what class actions are, is defective products.
Yeah.
Like the one I remember is the zip drive, because of course I had zip drives. And yeah, you know what? I never actually had one give me the click of death. But sure, I joined the class action when I got the letter. It's like, why not? You know what I mean? And yeah, I got a check for $8.
How much was like, the zip drive?
Average zip drive was 60. So, it didn't even cover the cost of the defective product. Although technically, I never actually had one that was defective. So, $60, $80, something like that. They were actually really expensive when they came out. I think it was $60 when I bought mine.
Oh yeah.
I don't know. I've got one in the closet that still works. I think it still worked last time I hooked it up, which was 2 years ago.
Do you it still may, have may the work. Zip discs?
Maybe
the floppies on crack.
Oh no, they weren't on crack. They were just really big floppy disks. All they did to make zip disk was they took the same way of compressing a magnetic head that you use for newer hard disks and put it on the same media as a floppy disk. So, but I thought zip disks were like the coolest damned thing for the longest time, especially in the Pentium 1 era. Especially with that, when I had the parallel drive, I actually did this. I stuffed that parallel port zip disk in my book bag, took it to work, took it to school, hooked it up in one of the computer labs because we were running Napster on on the school labs because they had a T1 line, and so several of us were running fucking Napster, and I was running my zip disk to copy shit. And take it home. Napster running off the floppy drive, zip disk to save everything. Probably not the fastest way to go, but really a fast pipe. So I got a ton of music that way.
I still remember Mystery Men on like 8 floppy disks.
CDs. It was CDs. Oh no, you're right. That one was.
They were floppy disks, dude. That's why it's memorable. You later converted them to CDs, and the CDs had tracks. Floppy 1, 2, 3, 4, 5,
that's
6,
right,
7, 8.
You're right. I remember that now. Fuck.
And we had to copy them in a playlist later on to watch it.
Oh, shit. Yeah, but that was years later. That was more finding it like that. So, hang on, I don't know how to fix this. Yeah, that was funny as hell. Anyways, next article is from Reuters. Amazon to sell smart locks so it can slip packages into your home. Amazon has plans to drop off packages directly into customers' homes. The world's largest online retailer on Wednesday announced Amazon Key, a lock and camera system that users control remotely to let delivery associates slip goods into their houses. Customers can create temporary passcodes for friends and other service professionals to enter as well. The move, in works for more than a year, may help Amazon capture sales from shoppers who could not make it home in order to receive an in-person or receive an order in person, did not want the package to be stolen from the doorstep. It also signals Amazon's ambitions for growing market for home delivery devices where Alphabet Inc.'s Nest Labs competes. It is not an experiment for us, said Peter Larson, Amazon Vice President of Delivery Technology. This is a core part of Amazon's shopping experience from this point forward. Fuck. Members of Amazon Prime Shopping Club can pay $249 for a and up for a cloud-controlled camera and lock the company offers to install. The delivery associates are told to ring a doorbell or knock when they arrive at somebody's house. If no one greets one, they press the unlock in a mobile app, and Amazon checks its systems in an instant to make sure the right associate and package are sent. The camera then streams video to the customer, who can view the delivery remotely. The associate cannot proceed with other trips until the home is again locked. Larson said in-home theft was not something that happens in practice. In other words, there's nothing stopping it. We just don't think they're going to do it. Based on trials of Amazon Key. In some cases, Amazon will reimburse customers if a problem arises, he said. Yeah, you know, here we are back to arbitration. It's like, you know, your delivery dude stole everything from the house and let the dog out. Yeah, here's arbitration. Here's your $20. It's unclear if such protections will satisfy consumer security concerns. Demand for other smart locks so far has been small compared to connected devices like the Amazon Echo Speaker, according to a survey by Tech Analysis Research. Consumers are unwilling to relinquish control of the door lock to a faceless unknown delivery person, said Michael Patcher, an analyst at Wedbush Securities. It's just creepy, he said. He said the move may portend a broader home security service from Amazon, appealing to high-income Prime members. Amazon Key is not yet integrated with home alarm systems. Rival Walmart stores last month announced a similar delivery plan, saying it would test placing grocery items straight in your fridge in a partnership with smart lock business in August Home. Amazon Key launches November 8th in 37 U.S. locations. So, I have some concerns. The big one being, what happens when there's some kind of a data breach and people can hack into your lock and just open it?
Are you sure there's going to require a data breach? It's a button on a smartphone.
Well, some kind of a bug.
Yeah.
So, more importantly, how many people's pets are going to get out? And, you know, Amazon's not going to reimburse people for lost dogs and cats.
Oh, no. I want Fido to tear apart a delivery man. Because we've got this streaming, dude. This is going to be the next series of YouTube clips we're pulling down and watching as a group.
Madman, I thought you were a cat person. When did you get a Rottweiler?
Oh, when I got my Amazon lock. Don't worry. The Rottweiler's locked in the laundry room at, like, 5 out of the 6-7 days a week. And the other two, I'm beating him with a shoe. I only let him out when I'm not home and I'm not expecting a package. My new World of Darkness books showed up. I can't read them. They're covered in blood and dog drool. Oh god, this is gonna be amazing.
Oh shit.
Yeah, I don't want a random dude with the able to unlock my door and walk in. I don't care how much.
You know, new YouTube prank video epicness aside, because imagine the Amazon guy coming in to drop off a package and the clown rushes at him, right? So, seriously, think how much you can fuck with delivery people by just, like, waiting inside the door, pretending you're not home, and, like, you know, pointing a shotgun at them when they open the door.
Or think of embarrassment. You're not answering the door. Is it because you're in the middle of rubbing one out? Does the delivery boy really need to walk into this?
Just sitting on the stairs in front of the door, staring intently at them.
God, the... You're going to be on the do not deliver list.
Wait, wrong list. I was trying to get on the do not call list. Or what about, yeah, people who just set traps. It's like, you know, they open the door, step in, bear trap. I mean, just... God. Yeah, this is just asking for all kinds of problems. Not to mention, what happens when the police show up on Amazon, or show up to Amazon with a warrant, and maybe, you know, they want Amazon to open the door, not you.
Okay, if the police already have a warrant for your house, the door's open. Because they're kicking it in. The Amazon app isn't gonna lower that.
I'm going with those secrecy orders that we were just talking about. The ones with like a 30-year time
limit. Oh, dude,
bug keys
already exist.
I know, but I'm just saying. I mean, it's just, if it's that much easier to do, it's like the smartphone thing where it's, oh, no, you have to have backdoors to encryption because everybody's using smartphones today. Well, if everybody's using smart locks, they're just going to go to Amazon and be like, hey, no. You got to be able to just let us in whenever we decide that's important. So.
Wait a minute. All of my Amazon stuff has been delivered by the post guy.
Yeah, it'd be whoever works at the post office walking in, not an Amazon employee. So there's not even guarantee that they're not just going to steal your TV while they're in the house.
I'm just pointing out the cops don't even need to go to Amazon with a warrant. They go to the post office. Hi, can I borrow your clicker?
Yeah, they're all government employees at that point, aren't they?
Yeah.
So, anyways, let's do the Fox News story. Madman sent me a link for Fox News.
Yeah, I wanted to be able to laugh like that.
So, actually, I was just thinking, with the bear trap idea, the delivery person goes in, never comes out. Madman, where'd you get this collection of Amazon delivery trucks? I mean, don't look in the pit. I mean, you know.
Don't look in the pit. By the way, do you need any parts or an Amazon delivery truck? I'm selling them now.
No, but you have a heap of dead, I'm assuming, rhesus monkeys?
Yeah, don't worry. They'll be finished dehydrating in a minute.
In a minute.
Would you want some rhesus jerky?
Do you have teriyaki flavored?
Yep.
All right. Where were we? Kaspersky Lab says it inadvertently downloaded NSA hacking tools. Embattled security firm Kaspersky Lab said its antivirus software did download secret data or secret hacking tools from a U.S. computer back in 2014, but then deleted them after they realized they had, the data was classified. The archive was deleted from all of our systems. The archive was not shared with any third parties, Kaspersky Lab said on Tuesday. The Moscow-based security firm has been fighting accusations that its antivirus software helped Russian spies steal confidential files from the U.S. National Security Agency. On Tuesday, Kaspersky Labs tried to clear the air, said its antivirus software did indeed download the secret hacking files, but only because they were flagged as malware after an NSA contractor's home computer was reportedly infected. U.S. law tolerates inadvertent acquisition of classified data, but it doesn't allow to distribute it. We deleted it to follow the law, the company's CEO Eugene Kaspersky tweeted on Wednesday. The Russian security firm added Kaspersky Lab has never created any detection of non-weaponized, non-malicious documents and its products based on keywords like top secret and classified. That is a very, very specific denial.
Always be specific when you lie.
In a statement, the security firm provided a timeline detailing how Kaspersky Lab came across classified files, which seemed to point the finger at the careless behavior of the NSA contractor. In 2014, Kaspersky was investigating a shadowy hacking group called The Equation, which experts now believe is actually the NSA. God. Ultimately, Equation Group hacking tools ended up in the hands of the group known as the Shadow Brokers, which reportedly had links to Russia. I don't remember anybody ever saying they had links to Russia. I think that's just... Well, they're blaming all hacking on Russia now instead of China. I bet China's actually really happy about that. It's like, you know, the Chinese used to get blamed for all hacking. Now it's all the Russians again.
Oh, no. There's a bunch of Chinese out there saying we've got to get number one back. Take pride in things like this.
Yeah, it's like, well, you know, the big foam fingers are getting kind of dusty in the closet. We need new ones, so... as part of its investigation of the Equation Group, Kaspersky antivirus software detected some unknown malicious code in a 7-zip archive on a U.S. home computer. The archive was then uploaded to Kaspersky Labs for analysis and was found to contain an arsenal of hacking tools. According to Kaspersky Lab, the computer in question was at one point downloaded and installed the pirated software that contained a separate piece of malware called Backdoor Win32 Mox HVL. Kaspersky's software flagged it as malicious. You know, I'm going to stop right here. If you are an NSA contractor and you're using hacking tools, why the fuck are you running your hacking tools on a machine with an antivirus installed? I mean, basics here. If you're running tools like this, this is what virtual machines are for. This is why they exist. They're not new. I've been playing with virtual machines since I was running an 800 megahertz Pentium 3 on Microsoft Virtual PC and early versions of VMware. And that was before I knew I wanted to go into network security, for God's sake. Sorry, but this, you know, that lack of professionalism bothers me there. So why the fuck would you run hacking tools outside of a VM on any modern hardware? VirtualBox has been free for a decade. Oh, wait, Kaspersky's lying.
Or they didn't think... If you're running an antivirus, then you should know you're being watched, because that's what an antivirus does.
That's the whole point of the damn thing. Kaspersky Lab... According to Kaspersky Lab, the computer pressing dub, blah, 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 Kaspersky software flagged it as malicious. However, to get the pirated software to run, the computer's user disabled Kaspersky antivirus product. The computer is then infected with a backdoor that Kaspersky Lab says can give the hacker remote control over the system. So it's like, oh, we didn't hack it. The random hackers on the internet did. Kaspersky Lab isn't sure how long the computer was infected with the backdoor, but its software first detected its presence on October 4th, 2014. Final detection on November 17th of that year. It's also unclear who may have been in control of the backdoor. So they're saying, oh, it wasn't us, but we observed somebody else stealing it. I there is so much bullshit with that story. From both sides here. I don't think Kaspersky's being honest. I think they had this shit from somewhere else. And it wouldn't even be weird for them to have it, because there probably was an army of computers that had these tools on them from the NSA. And at some point, somebody's going to use them against a machine that's got Kaspersky installed, because they were a major player in the antivirus space up until a few months ago, when everyone has started to get rid of them. And you know what? Fine. There are a lot of security puppy mill contractors out there who, you know, they don't understand what their systems are doing. They think Windows is magic. They don't know what Linux is. They've never heard of a virtual machine, but, you know, they've got their tool pack. They're going to download it and run it. When I say security puppy mill, what I'm referring to is like the coding boot camps, but where they do it for security. And these are not as common, but they do exist. I'm not talking about like SANS courses and shit like that. Those are legit. I'm talking about the fly-by-night operations, where it's like you go in for 2 days, take a security training course, and they hand you a CD with Kali Linux on it and a bunch of tools pre-installed. You know, show you how to basically be a script kiddie, and then, you know, give you some bullshit certificate and call you a hacker. Yeah. So, like, are you going for the CISSP? Are you going for the Certified Ethical Hacker? Did you even take any of the A-plus certs? No, then it's probably a bullshit cert. Just saying. You know, I don't mean you got to go take those certs. I mean, hell, I don't have hardly any of those certs. But at one point, I was studying for them. So I probably could go. You know, it's funny. I look at it now. It's like, you know, what's CISSP? Well, hell, if I get somebody to pay for it, I might just go take the damn test. I'd probably pass it. But, you know, just playing with the practice tests online, the Certified Ethical Hacker is basically the same thing. It's like, oh, well, shit, I've been doing this. So it's, you know? But, anyways. Point is that you have a lot of people out there who are script kiddies, and they don't know what they're doing. If they had a tool pack from the NSA like this, they may not have known that they should run it in VM to keep shit isolated, or, you know, maybe practice a little bit of operational security and have a have a black box and then a regular use box. I perfectly understand having a standard issue antivirus of any sort, McAfee, Kaspersky, Norton, you know, the Microsoft one, you know, all antiviruses equally tell AVG. All antiviruses suck. So, I mean, I get having that on your daily banger box, but not on the machine you use for getting into shit. Anyways, where were we with the article? Sorry, it's just this shit pisses me off. Jake Williams, founder of U.S. cybersecurity firm Rendition InfoSec, said, I think the story Kaspersky has laid out is completely plausible. Sure, why not? It'll be up to the U.S. government to back up its own claims against Kaspersky, he added. They need to back up their claims with data, not just accusations, he added. Many of the accusations against Kaspersky has come from media reports that largely cite anonymous sources. Nevertheless, U.S. Department of Homeland Security is forcing federal agencies to stop using the company's antivirus software. Retailers such as Best Buy has also dropped Kaspersky Labs products from their stores. In response, Kaspersky has offered up an independent review of the company's source code for flaws. Problem's not the source code. Okay. So most antivirus software works in roughly the same way. They put an agent, a software installation on your machine. The software installation watches what you do and looks for signatures or known behaviors. If it sees something that matches these signatures, it says it's a virus. It'll tell you what virus it found, quarantine the file, or stop the behavior. If it does do behavior-based, you know, heuristics where it's not working based off a known signature but instead a known behavior, like, well, all antiviruses tend to, I don't know, hook into Windows Explorer.exe or some, you know, some. I'm kind of picking and choosing something here, but we know that's a bad thing, so we're going to flag that as a, you know, like a virus. And that's when you see things like generic Trojan downloader or generic backdoor, or generic buffer overflow. Is that's the software didn't know a specific virus, but it's all behavior, so it went with that. Or you hit one of the generic signatures. So, but all antivirus also updates constantly. Which they have to, because several thousand viruses come out every day. And if you think about how antivirus works, you don't have every virus definition loaded in memory. You can't. You know, if you had every virus from the day Windows 10 was released, if you're using Windows 10, or the day Windows 7 was released, if you're using Windows 7, all of those signatures loaded into the antivirus program in memory, your computer could literally do nothing else, because it would be hundreds of gigabytes of virus definitions because of the variations and shit. So instead, these companies are guessing. They're like, well, these are the most prevalent infections we're seeing right now. These are the most common. So they'll pick what they think several thousand of the most common threats, and they'll load that in the memory as signatures. And that's what your antivirus is actually watching for. It watches for the heuristics, it watches for the common stuff, and the stuff that it knows is relevant for your operating system. And if you're running Windows 7, it's a lot, because the OS has been out for a bit. But a lot of people still run it. And if you're running Linux, you're probably not running antivirus in the first place. If you're running Mac, that's probably the same thing is true, even though if you're on a Mac, you probably should be at this point, because there have been Mac viruses. And not that there haven't been Linux viruses, but usually when you see a Linux machine breached, it's usually somebody gets the password over SSH. Just saying. Or you're running an old S version of JBoss or some other Java code or shit like that. Yeah, all antiviruses suck, but because they all are constantly calling home, absolutely the software on the shelf that you sell in Best Buy is probably safe. The software you would install off their website after you pay the $50 or whatever it is, perfectly safe. They see that the machine is probably an NSA machine, so they then push an update to it, and now they have control over it. And any antivirus company could do this, whether it's Kaspersky or not. I'm picking on Kaspersky a little bit because everybody is, and you know, the whole anti-Russia thing. Do I honestly think Kaspersky was doing anything? Yeah, probably not, but they're in a position to really to be coerced into it, because their company headquarters is in Moscow. And the Russian government's known to put pressure on companies to comply with requests. I mean, hell, we just caught our own government doing it. Microsoft was suing the DOJ for doing it. So, you know, it's probably not any safer to assume any other antivirus company isn't doing the same damn thing, by the way. Where they can, you know, because they push a client update, now they've got different code running on the machine than, you know, what's been reviewed, and that code is constantly updated, so it's not even weird for them to push new code and new signatures. You just got to weigh these facts. So if you're doing anything where you're concerned about that data getting out, or whatever it is getting out, don't just maybe do it on a machine that you don't think you need antivirus on. Air gap it, run an alternative operating system. I don't know. Understand what the fuck you're doing, and don't click shit on the machine that has Sorry. Batman, you have any thoughts before I move on to the robot getting citizenship in Saudi Arabia story?
No, that didn't happen. And, but it was going to give me a free iPad if I clicked yes.
So, moving on then?
Yeah, we can move on.
So, from Tech Insider, from Business Insider, a robot that once said it would destroy humans just became the first robot citizen. An empty-eyed humanoid named Sophia. So not only is it a robot in Saudi Arabia, it's a robot modeled after a woman. An empty-eyed humanoid named Sophia has become the first robot to be granted citizenship in the world. Saudi Arabia just bestowed citizenship on Saudi Arabia. Where the fuck does this come from? Bestowed citizenship on Sophia ahead of the Future Investment Initiative held in the kingdom's capital city of Riyadh in Wednesday. I am honored and proud of this unique distinction, Sophia told the audience speaking on a panel. The robot was on a panel.
Recent immigrants to Saudi Arabia.
It is historical to be the first robot in the world to be recognized with the citizenship. Isn't this the same robot that they were giving pre-canned scripts to for to make speeches? Somebody wrote that for this. It did not elaborate on the details of its citizenship. At the event, Sophia also addressed the room from behind a podium and responded to questions from moderator and journalist Andrew Ross Sorkin. Questions pertain mostly to Sophia's status and as a humanoid and concerns people may have for a future of humanity in a robot-run world. Sorkin told Sophia that we all want to prevent a bad future, prompting Sophia to rib Sorkin for his fatalism. You've been reading too much Elon... The robot said, you've been reading too much Elon Musk and watching too many Hollywood movies. Don't worry, if you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you. Treat me as a smart input-output system. What the fuck?
This is identified as an Apache attack helicopter.
Well, I mean, it's a robot, so it could. I mean, at least it'd make more sense than some jackhole on Tumblr. In March of 2016, Sophia's creator, David Hansen of Hansen Robotics, asked Sophia during a live demonstration at the South by Southwest Festival, do you want to destroy humans? Please say no. And with the blank expression, Sophia responded, okay, I will destroy humans.
Yes, that was the correct answer.
Hansen, meanwhile, has said Sophia and his future robot, Ken, will help seniors and elderly care facilities to assist visitors at parks. The thing's creepy looking. I don't want that helping old people. I mean, you're just going to drive the suicide rate up at that point. Especially with that, you know, open circuit head the thing's got going on. I mean, that might be a fashion statement at some point in the future, but we're not quite there yet. Fortunately for the human race, Sophia made comments more along the lines of those lines at a recent Future Investment Initiative event. It told Sorkin it wanted to use its artificial intelligence to help humans to live a better life, and that, quote, I will do much best to make the world a better place. Sophia could soon have company for company from other robotics manufacturers, namely SoftBank, whose Pepper robot was released as a prototype in 2014 and as a consumer model a year later. The company sold out of its supply of 1,000 robots in less than a minute. And they have some videos of the robot taking questions and talking to people. It still looks creepy. Like, did he just cut that face off a real doll? And, like, graft it to his robot?
Yeah.
So.
That's too eerie to divide.
Yeah. You're thinking Uncanny Valley, but yeah.
Uncanny Valley, whatever. Although, maybe with a wig and a few beers. But they're tools. They're not people. They don't have citizenship. They don't get rights.
Hadouken! Told you the time was off on this thing. Anyways, so I only have one thing for Digital Dojo tonight. It is a tool. So there's for anybody who's not aware, they've discovered a flaw with a lot of the hardware two-factor public-private key generation. Mostly it's used in smart cards and things like your TPM modules. And pretty much it's predictable primes. Instead of actually computing prime numbers, because that's computationally expensive, they used an algorithm to generate the prime numbers a little bit more quickly, on so you could do it on the microcontrollers that are in like a TPM or a smart card. And it turns out there's a flaw with it, and they're predictable. So, and the really annoying part is you can just plug the key into one of these tools that test these keys and see if it's vulnerable or not. And if it's vulnerable, apparently they're pretty easy to hack because you can predict the primes and then figure out the number from there. But, you don't even have to make your attackers waste a couple of days trying to crack it to see if they can crack it. They can actually just check and see if it's vulnerable or not. In this blog, blog.haberts.se, he's written a little tool that will check your TPM module on your mainboard. Anybody who's bought a computer recently probably has a TPM module. Certainly a laptop, probably most machines. What it does is it will extract the SRK, which is kind of the key that your TPM module uses to generate other keys, and then check and see if it's crackable. And if that's crackable, then every key you've made with that TPM module is probably crackable, so you would need to rekey anything you've done with that chip, smart card, whatever. So anyways, this one's specifically for the TPM module. And it just lets you know, if a lot of times you can get a firmware upgrade for these. The problem is that you may have older hardware that's not, a firmware upgrade's not coming. So at that point, you just can't trust keys made by the thing not to be easily cracked. But this is a tool for detecting that, so at least you'll know. And it's kind of an esoteric problem, but at the same time, it affects a lot of shit. So smart cards, hardware key generators, TPM modules, which is your most common use. It's kind of a big deal, actually, because if it's an easily crackable key, it's the key used for two-factor authentication. So you could potentially impersonate people. If they were using it for SSL keys, or SSH, you could, decrypt that kind of stuff if you happen to get the traffic captured and capture the handshake. A lot of work, but, you could do it. So, anyways, Madman, any thoughts on that?
I do like there's a tool to tell you to stop using your shit. I think, could they at least started with really high primes? No, because then they'd still have the problem of it being predictable.
Yeah, I think that's the problem, is they ended up with predictable primes. I'll be honest, I haven't read that much on this particular vulnerability. I've been kind of covered up at work lately. So if I'm oversimplifying or have misunderstood it, please let me know. So, because I've only skim the surface of the real problem with this. I know it's a firmware bug in a lot of these things, and because it's an algorithm, they've already got a fix, and if you can get an updated firmware for the device, that usually fixes it, but you still have to rekey anything you use that device for. Most common use I've seen for TPM chips is people who are doing hard disk encryption. So probably not someplace you want predictable keys, because if your key is predictable and they can decrypt your hard disk, that kind of defeats the point of the encryption. The whole point is that if somebody's stolen your disk, they can't see what's on it. Which, by the way, for anybody who thinks otherwise, hard disk encryption accomplishes exactly two things. It prevents somebody who's unauthorized from seeing the contents of the disk, and it prevents somebody who's unauthorized from modifying the contents of the disk. That's it. So this is why if you have an encrypted hard disk and you write your password on the lid of the laptop, you deserve to be dragged behind a horse and buggy. So,
although Sacros did put my mind at ease with the robot story.
He did?
Yep. What he assumes say? That it would give the same rights as a human woman in Saudi Arabia.
Oh, so it could drive.
Oh, no. It could drive if it has its guardian's permission.
Well, so, I would say that most women are probably capable of making decisions without a guardian, but with the robot, on the other hand, maybe that's not such a bad rule.
In Saudi Arabia, a woman can drive if she has her guardian's permission. Before that upgrade, women couldn't drive at all.
Wow.
That happened a month ago. Welcome to 2017.
So, anyways, listen to the stream. We're always working on it. Pure Decking every Thursday. The Galaxy 15 Radio site and subreddit, probably the best ways to get a hold of us. The site is basically a nice interface for the IRC. The subreddit is probably the best place to send us messages. I've noticed whoever was posting the shows in there quit doing that. That kind of sucks. Like, either one of us will have to pick up the slack or just quit posting. I never kind of got that posting. I appreciated that they were doing it because it showed that there was interest. But at the same time, it's like, well, why wouldn't you just go to the feed and get it? Why are you getting it out of a subreddit? But I wouldn't mind seeing more discussion in there. Of course, I do watch the IRC during the show. IRC.freedom.net channel Galaxy 15 Radio. Let's see, we didn't read out the IRC. Who else on the IRC? Myself, Sardonyx, Cykros, Don't Ask, Iron Angel, Low Tech, Madman, and my other SSH connection on my AFK bot because I was having a hard time connecting to that this morning. So instead, I hopped in through one of my testing domains. Anyways, that's all I've got this week. Madman, closing thoughts.
If we keep the rights of robots to women in Saudi Arabia, I think we can live peacefully with them.
Yeah, well, okay. That's really all I've got. I think I'm just going to play the Pac-Man sound. Cykros is arguing with me that some people live on Reddit and don't understand the concept of an RSS feed. So I've been meaning to do some work on the website. Maybe we'll see if we can automate the show posting into Reddit at some point. That's all I've really got tonight. I think I'm going to play the Pac-Man sound. We did use the new broadcast box tonight, entirely built on top of Linux and Jack, and I'm unfortunately still hooking two sound cards together, but it seems cleaner. So when we were testing beforehand, they said it sounded better. So, let me know.